Okay, today is March 19th, 2014. This is the third and probably final interview with Peyton Smith. We are here inside the University Archives, which is inside Steenbach Memorial Library, and my name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Peyton, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell either your first or your last name?
My name is Peyton Smith, and my first name is P-E-Y-T-O-N.
Okay. I think I have this turned down a little bit, so I'm going to turn it up.
I'm sure when I did the interviews, I messed that up a couple times.
But the sound quality was fine, and it's going to be fine here, too. I'm
good.
Quite confident. So, Peyton, I gave you a list of questions I wanted to ask on this final interview. The first comes from, you talked quite a bit in the second interview about the sesquicentennial.
Yes.
But I want to ask sort of the legacy question of that specifically. So first off, what do you think was the legacy of the sesquicentennial, first off, for you personally?
Well, I think, to tell you the truth, I think the legacy is I survived and was a state employee, because I called five senior academic staff across the country who had run major celebrations for 150 to 250 year anniversaries of university. One was Princeton, that's where the 250. And four of the five people no longer work for the institution. They said, hey, it's a tough thing. But so, you know, I was just happy to survive, to tell you the truth. But I did it because it was strategically designed to help improve relationships with alumni, with donors, with Wisconsin stakeholders, taxpayers that were involved in political decision-making or involved in nonprofit groups or something. And then, of course, politicians. So we were hoping to improve the relationship the university has with the state. But I never had any feeling that this would be a slam dunk or anything like that, because when I took the job, I was approached by Art Hovey, David Cronin, and John Jenkins. And John Jenkins and David Cronin were working on the UW History Project at the time. And Art Hovey had done a history book of Wisconsin, but they were very familiar with what was going on. And they told me, when I asked them, okay, what happened about the 125th anniversary? And the 125th anniversary of the university had seen great support from the state, great support, a letter from the president and everything, and the next year the university experienced its biggest budget cut in history, is what they told me. So I had no illusions that there'd be some great legacy, but what I thought we'd do is take a moment in time to help advance what the campus was doing. So previously I talked about what I thought was the importance of a strategic plan that was coherent. And David Ward, who was chancellor at the time, in the personal interview I had with him after a committee interview before taking the position to coordinate the university sesquicentennial activities, I was appreciative because what we were doing is trying to organically help the university continue its evolution to do good things for the state. And my entire career, if you look at what I did, was more involved in the outreach activities, in the transfer of technology and applications of educational opportunities to the state, the Wisconsin idea. You know, what resources we have on campus, what benefits we have on campus should be shared by the state, which is really one of the hallmarks of this university from my point of view and from the tutors I had. So I was just hoping we could do some things like that. So I really don't think there's a legacy of the 150th anniversary, but I do believe there's some neat things that happened that will continue. An undergraduate research symposium was created and continues. A campus visitors program was reassessed, reevaluated, and really sort of put into today's day and age what's needed for the campus. So there were a lot of activities that grew organically from the institution. There were stronger ties developed between the University of Wisconsin Foundation, the Wisconsin Alumni Association, and the campus in general, in terms of how you move forward together. And today, in 2014, the Alumni Association, Wisconsin Alumni Association, and the University of Wisconsin Foundation are merging. So I don't look at this as a legacy of that, but I look at it as a continuing trend that helps the institution move forward. And I hadn't seen any other university where, when they did something, that it was like, oh, wow, this really changed the institution forever, you know. So I was real pleased that I would say 80% of it was more strategic than celebratory, and celebratory is needed. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we need to reward the chorus and the cheerleaders, you know, for doing the good things. So I was really, I think that's really the legacy, is really not personal or that celebration did anything, but the fact that we just slowly kept the institution thinking critically and moving forward. We did fund in small amounts, and it was all through the foundation, University of Wisconsin Foundation. We didn't use state money for these kind of things. But we gave people very small amounts of money to host symposiums or events in which they explored their future, in which they looked at how they could become more productive and responsive. And so that was sort of nice too, that so many people embraced that as an opportunity to not just have a birthday cake, mm-hmm. but to do something. We did have an open house on campus, which drew 20,000 people, and that wasn't done in a long time. It helped us move forward in some areas. But you know, those areas only go as good as the people who are the next generation of leaders. So, mm-hmm. But I didn't take the job thinking it would be a ground changer or an earth mover for the institution, but just sort of would continue to move us forward. And again, the theme we had is the University of Wisconsin is your resource for a lifetime. So it embraced my goal that the assets of the university are not just for the undergraduate and graduate students who come here, but for the people of the state and the nation and in many cases the world. So it sounds sort of pie in the sky, but that's really why I did it.
Okay, thank you. my second question is, towards the end of the second interview, you had a comment that you almost died and that changed your energy but not your passion. I think I'd be remiss though if I didn't ask a little bit about this health scare that you had, when you had it and what it was and what its effect was on you.
Well, I was just a few months before my 45th birthday, and I had a low-grade infection. I didn't know what it was, and I'm a guy, so you muddle through. You know, everything's okay. And I ended up with a full-blown case of pancreatitis, and it blew out my pancreas. And I almost died. I was 28 days in the hospital. And then as a result, I developed diabetes from the injury to the pancreas, because it produces the insulin that helps you digest food and deal with your blood sugars. And that was sort of a whack upside the head in terms of my energy. I always felt as if I had sort of a boundless task of energy to do things. So I grew up during the hippy-dippy kind of years, if you will, you know, the anti-Vietnam War, the Vietnam War pro kind of debates that were going on in schools and society and families, as we talked about earlier. And I always wanted to do something that I thought would have value for the world, not just make money. And this is probably, you know, in a way, my dad is a very beautiful and good man and had great values, but he was a salesperson and it was just about the money. And I personally wanted to do something that I thought had some societal value. And I have no clue why, but that's what it was. So working for the University of Wisconsin-Madison was something that I thought was good. My first job was involved in a Sea Grant College, the Sea Grant Research Program turned into a college program, which administratively doesn't mean much to the world, but it does to the strength of the program and federal grants. And it was a state-federal matching program, two-thirds federal dollars, one-third state dollars required, and it was a federal competitive granting program. And a hallmark of that program was the Wisconsin idea. And so from the beginning, my first job on campus was working in an area where I was helping to translate what we were doing on campus to an external audience, whether it was a school child, a teacher, a bank. How do you make loans for coastal property that's eroding? And sometimes the water goes down, you extend the property, then it erodes. Where's the high water mark? They actually had a business impact in the state and had an impact on ports. How do you help marinas deal with ice? So we had research going on those things, and I was involved usually in helping to transfer the results of that research, because Sea Grant was an applied research program, meaning that what you were doing was supposed to have some benefit to people off campus other than just advancing basic science knowledge or advancing an undergraduate or graduate educational program. So I started off with this, and the director of the program, Bob Rogatsky, constantly would talk in the federal government, in the state government, and to other groups of people about the fact that the foundations of the University of Wisconsin-Madison are academic freedom, as with the great Board of Regents statement, that we will always pursue education, and, you know, that knowledge. Interdisciplinary research, that's a real big hallmark of this institution, and one that I didn't know was so unusual around the world, because I grew up in an interdisciplinary program where people from economics were dealing with people from biology, were dealing with people from engineering to deal with something. And that was really exciting for me. So at Sea Grant, here I am on a research program where you have opportunities to get grants. Once you're successful in some areas, you can go to foundations, you can go to other people, you can go to partnerships with the Department of Natural Resources, with agencies in the state, with historical societies in the state, depending upon what you're doing. And that gave me not only a passion that, boy, you're doing something good, you know, that there's some educational value or some value of the research that's happening to the people, but what a wonderful way to work where you have an opportunity to help shape some of the projects you're involved in with a group of creative people that were most of the time not limiting. Most of the time my bosses were, think outside the way we normally do. If you can make improvements, that's okay with me if you change things up. Mm-hmm. You know, so I had really people who fostered innovation and fostered my creativity, and that kept me going with a passion. So when I almost died, you know, I had another, I had moved out of Sea Grant and moved into the provost office and the Office of Outreach Development, Division of University Continuing Studies. These also were involved in programs that transferred the knowledge and expertise of the university to the public. So I kept, you know, doing that. And I, when I moved up to Bascom, I still had the provost office, Joe Corey in the Office of Outreach Development, or Howard Martin, the dean of the Division of University Outreach, and then through its various renditions to the dean of the Division of Continuing Studies, who actually helped me by allowing me to look at what was going on and make suggestions. And they, if they were advancing the strategic direction of the unit, advancing the unit along with where the campus was going. As I said, I really liked that strategic plan. It allowed me to make arguments to my bosses that these are the best things we could do in the future. So in proposing and suggesting things, I got to do some of my own projects, and that kept my passion alive. So yes, while I almost died, and it was real hard getting the energy level back I had in some ways, you know, being able to do good things and being able to have bosses that enabled you, well, I guess enabled you is not the necessarily the rightest, the most correct word, but allowed you the luxury to be unfettered with, oh, the boss is going to say no, to come up with ideas that could best move the institution forward from that particular unit's point of view, and actually supported that. And I had that from also John Wiley, who was my boss in the provost office for only 6 months, but then moved to the chancellor's office. And actually, I had a special deal to work for the chancellor's office with him And that also gave me the ability to do things on my own. And that's sort of important, you know, as an academic staff in a great big institution like this, we often don't have those choices. You know, we're more often in a support role. So I guess I'm hoping to say that. So the pancreatitis really set me back. It was about 3 months before I was physically able to really put in a full day of work and not feel exhausted. But I never had the energy level I had after that, but I always had the passion. And actually that when I lost my passion was when I decided to leave the university. Mm-hmm. So,
and we'll get to that directly in a couple more questions. You alluded to academic staff, and I know one of the things that you wanted to have some space to talk about was academic staff's role on campus. And I'm wondering if there's more you want to say than what you just alluded to in terms of academic staff.
Well, okay, I have a few thoughts about the role of academic staff, and there's faculty and students, you know, those are, and then there's classified staff. Those are the big groups of people on campus. To the real world, they don't mean much, you know, other than students and teachers or faculty. But in this world, I came into the university when academic staff numbers started to grow tremendously. So academic staff, you're not tenured. When you started off like me on a grant, you're on soft money. You only have a job as long as you can bring the money in, which I actually think was a good thing because I had to justify what I was doing. It kept me sharp. I couldn't just sit back and go, I get a job, I can lay back. I always had to compete. And I'm somewhat of a competitive person. I don't have to be first, but I want to be good. And when you look at working at a Sea Grant program, starting off as a junior in college and getting a grant, and then becoming a staff member, and then you see once a year these 32 other programs around the country that you get together and meet with, and you realize you're one of the top programs, well, there's a sense of pride, and there's a sense of, well, we're supposed to be better, so I better be better, you know, that which really helped me move forward. And this was a time when academic staff, as I said, were growing in numbers, and we had a program where there was in the grant, the faculty were doing the research with the exception of a couple academic staff that had research status. And since the grant was signed off by a faculty, I actually had two projects as a project principal investigator, even though I didn't have PI status because he signed off on the whole $2 million grant versus my chunks of it. And that was really nice. I was given an opportunity, I believe I mentioned this in the first interviews, to be involved in some strategic planning on where the program was going in the future, how we're connecting all the different parts, because you'd have five or six projects working on one specific a challenge, whether it was the fisheries of the Great Lakes or the water quality of the Great Lakes or the Green Bay, you know, the pollution from the Fox River in the Green Bay and how you needed to either let it sink and settle or do some remedial action and dig it up. Those are problems that involve a lot of different people looking at things, including governmental agencies. And that was sort of nice, and I was given a boss who respected that. And when you met with people, the faculty and all that would look and say, well, this person is going to help me translate my work to the public. They respected you completely. Then when I moved up to Bascom in administration, I saw a different view of it. Well, some faculty are working in departments, and they see the world from a law department, or they see the world from a school of education department, or from a college of letters and science department. They see one model on how things work. And in some of the academic departments, you don't have as, there's a lot more instructional academic staff now, but I wasn't instructional academic staff. You know, I was involved in doing things and working for things and providing support or administrative support in some of my activities. But I always had projects up until my last year, when the projects started derailing because of administration change. But so from an academic staff point of view, here my first 16 years on campus, I was brought up in it's sort of like, wow, you can really be respected, you're part of the team. You move to Bascom in administration, and you find that in some cases, when bring faculty up into a new associate dean or an associate vice provost position, they didn't necessarily work with academic staff. And they were almost like a tier structure. You know, you're an assistant to. So here I worked in a collaborative environment. Now, let me take one step back and say that I worked with dean's offices in many ways for 20 years, 10 years intimately. And in dean's offices, and all the deans were faculty that moved into administration, there are some deans that are more difficult to work with than others, and not that many to tell you the truth, because I didn't have to get involved in things where you'd have the difficult things were moving, you know, in advance. I believe that they actually, the deans, administrative staffs, because they had academic staff around them helping them, were also very respectful for the most part to academic staff. Now, you can have one person who may not be a good manager, who can be respectful or non-respectful to different people. Those are outliers. What I'm talking about is how they're viewing you. And I had chancellors who viewed academic staff as capable of doing things to change the institution. David Ward and John Wiley were not going to ask an academic staff member like me to go in and change a curriculum for a school and college. But they can ask me to go in and do something that doesn't involve the curriculum or the degree requirements and help the college move forward or the school on some things. And I was always treated with respect on that. Where I found it interesting was in the provost office, we had a vice provost. Well, they were vice, they were associate vice chancellors, and then we changed the name from vice chancellor for academic affairs to provost and vice chancellor for academic affairs. So the associate vice provost became the associate provost in my tenure. But I had a faculty member from, and that was the 3 to 5 year stint. So I had someone from law, I had someone from School of Education, I had someone from College of Letters and Science. And they came into the provost office to determine whether they probably wanted to continue in administration or do something else. And a lot of them, to tell you the truth, brought great skill sets from an academic department point of view or a faculty point of view, but didn't understand how the whole campus worked. That you can legally deal with fiscal issues differently, you know, as long as it's legal, you know. And so there were different policies or different ways of doing things that schools and colleges did. Well, I grew up federal grants, state funds, program revenue, grants from gifts, grants, and other contracts. And so I saw, okay, here are the different and here are the different sources of money. Here's how they work. Some you have to bring in indirect costs plus, you know, your fringe benefits and your salary. Some that are internal, like if a gift is given to the foundation, you only have to, you know, if you're getting money from there, deal with the salary and the fringe benefit costs, but not indirect costs. And with program revenue as well, what department are you in? How do you set up? Which account do you set up? What's the best one to do, given what you're doing? And then, you know, you need to follow state procedures. A lot of the faculty had no clue of that because they didn't have to deal with those kind of things. So a lot of them came in what I would call a revolving door of, let's see how your management experience goes, whether you want to continue or not. And they'd have to get up to speed and drop, and you'd have to respond to them and not respond to them. I mean, I had a law professor say, pull out the standard template chancellor's letter. Well, there may be a template for a legal, you know, issue where they may have the beginnings of what you need to say, but there are no template. Here's what a chancellor is normally going to answer. So, I mean, there's some formulas, if you will. Thank you very much for your comments, and, you know, we'll take them into consideration, and we really appreciate it, or whatever. But, you know, and I drafted a lot of letters for deans and chancellors and provosts. I mean, you know, but so it was really funny how they operated. And some, actually, and I challenged this, would treat you as a subservient assistant, and you're in a meeting, and here you have relationships with colleagues, and you're a senior person working for the provost, working on a chancellor's project, and you have someone saying, let my assistant, I'll give this to my assistant. And, you know, I knew I was not top dog or anything, but that can make the other people in the committee think that you don't have the standing that you have. So I challenged that. I challenged every vice provost that I had and pointed out to them. And a couple of them actually got angry with me. And a couple of them looked and said, oh, I had no idea. And I even challenged the chair of a university committee, where the chancellor and the provost were asking me to move a campus project forward. And they didn't have many people who were sort of a, not a jack of all trades, but someone who could play utility positions more than one. Mm-hmm. And so I was asked to do something like that. I would go from the into dean's offices and say, geez, the chancellor asked me to come in, or the provost asked me to come in. And never once did someone say, are you kidding? A chair of the university committee actually went back, and if I said something, he'd have to go back and email the provost and the chancellor to get their answer. Where the provost and the chancellor in a meeting with me one time said, well, Pat Farrell said, why is this person always asking me when you're already helping me to do that? So I met with them and I said, am I your colleague or not? This has never happened to me before. Why are you doing this? And, well, it was because he said, oh, well, you know, I didn't realize what I was doing. But those kind of things, you know, and when they're talking committees and say things, make it oftentimes somewhat difficult. So I do believe that at times the structure of what we have, academic staff are around on a longer-term basis in some positions, faculty might move in or out, and that creates some disconnect. And particularly, I believe, in administration, you know, where you have people coming in and moving out. I had another situation where two executive assistants to the top person on campus offered me 10% raise to come into the and do something. And when I got to the chancellor's office, oh, we can't do it right now. We'll wait till the raise comes around. Well, the raise comes around as a state issue, so that may or may not happen. And in the last 10 years of my career, you didn't get raises. You got mostly the same or pulled back, you know. I can't remember, furloughs and things like that. Well, you go to work for the chancellor and you can't go to the chancellor and say, I came up here and left my other position on a handshake, and now that person said no, we'll wait, because I didn't have the backup. And administratively, from the state of Wisconsin law, when you're an academic staff and you work for a dean or a chancellor or provost, you're automatically a one-year appointment. Versus the three-year, when I got grants, you know, I get 3 years grants, hey, at least I get a three-year appointment, unless I screw up, you know. So it's a different situation, and I believe that in administration, at the closer you are to the higher levels, in my career, I saw more turnover of staff. There are a few people who are still around when I was around, but it seemed to me more of a turnover, depending on a new administrator comes in. And so I'll mention the passion thing. You know, when we had so much change in leadership, and when leadership was wondering what to do, and when Biddy Martin came in, I actually sat for a year and was doing some projects for the chancellor, but was put on hold for everything else. And after, like I say, almost dying at 45, and working another, and that would be 20 years then in Bascom, in administration. And I looked and said, oh my gosh, a whole other leadership change, a whole other group. I've got to convince these people that I am who I am, I'm worth working with, you know, here's my skill sets, it's outside of the norm. You know, it was a pretty disruptive period, and I actually thought that it would be best for me to move on, because if I don't have the passion to do good things, I should make way for other people who have passion to do good things, because they entrepreneurial aspects of this campus are so spectacular that I didn't want to sit back. Now, that being said, I have come back since retired and done a couple projects for the campus when they asked me. And, you know, and that gives me the ability to decide whether I want to or not. So, is this what you, is this, yep. Am I making any?
Yep. Thank you for that. So we have, and I sort of just hit the why retire there too. So a couple of specific things that you mentioned last time that I want to give you space to elaborate on. You mentioned last time having an interest in an acronym called CSUMSE, which is the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Culture.
Yeah.
Or cultures. So I'm interested in why you were interested in that, and specifically, I know you ended up writing a foreword or an introduction to a book called Wisconsin Talk. So I'm going to give you some space to talk a little bit about your interest in CSUMSE, and then what eventually led to the writing the piece for Wisconsin Talk.
The Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures is illustrative, if you will, of an outreach effort that I was involved in helping to spawn or create, where the faculty actually came to me and asked me for my advice. Well, for good reason. I was involved in a grant program at Sea Grant. When I moved to the Office of Outreach Development, we were making some extra money on our continuing education programs. So we decided to give $1 million back to the campus in a grant outreach program. And we developed this, it wasn't $1 million at that time, it was a little less. That was the initial one for outreach development. We developed a small grants program where people could get some money. And so, of course, when people are writing grants and you're helping to review them and you're offering an opportunity to help them shape the argument most appropriately for what the money should be allocated for, that would be the transfer of knowledge and expertise from the university to a specific group. They need a partner, they need a potential outcome. Well, that one, after doing it for a year and analyzing it, we realized it's nice to give small amounts of money, but you're not gonna make much change. So a couple of years later, we had $1 million that we decided to put out, and we put on there, well, you give at least $100,000 to $150,000 out to help someone start something, you know, to help them make change. One of the proposal, and that was called, this was before the Ira and Aneva Riley Baldwin Wisconsin ID Endowment. So this came from the Division of Continuing Studies, Howard Martin, and he asked me to write the criteria with him, and that was called the Wisconsin ID Initiative. And we were doing this sort of as an experiment. John Wiley knew what we were doing when he was provost, and we were telling him that we were doing this and why we were doing it. And he liked the organic nature, give people an opportunity to grow from bottom up with ideas, and they'll do it. So the second edition, where we had enough money, one of the proposers that came in was to develop a center, and there's a National Endowment for Humanities said if they received so much money, they would also get an endowment to help build it. So they came in and they sat down and talked to me, and this was Joe Sammons, professor of German, and Jim Leary, of folklore, and they were sort of the co-directors at that time. And they're really fun and bright people. They know a lot of history. They know a lot about the state. They know some of the German culture. Well, I have a little deep roots in Wisconsin. Well, of course, here they are coming and respecting you and talking to you, and you say, well, here's, you know, this is a tough sell. And if I were you, this is what I might do. And I, you know, definitely I would focus on this aspect of your idea because it meets the criteria. And this other part that you're thinking about, you know, you can't do that here. Or if you do, we're just going to look at it and say, well, that doesn't meet the criteria, so you're really not going to get graded as high. So we developed a good relationship. They got that grant. Then they also developed a proposal for the Cluster Hire program, and they got some faculty to work in that area. So I also work with them in that area. I have a private project that I like to do myself, looking at grottos and concrete, Wisconsin concrete park artists, and not skate parks or something, but These are things where people built concrete statues in incomplete environments, and this was back in the 1920, 30, 40, 50, 60s. There was an immigrant culture part of it. It was concrete became inexpensive. People worked their entire lives, and they built these things. We have three gigantic religious grottos in the Midwest, two in Wisconsin, one in Iowa, and we have substantial concrete park in Wisconsin, and the John Michael Kohler Art Center in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, takes an expertise in these areas. They've actually bought them, fixed them, not the religious ones, the secular ones, and donated them back to nonprofit groups to maintain. So these are outside and eroding and losing. So I took pictures and wrote some articles about it. Well, the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures, I published them in their newsletters, and I worked through them because this is a cultural phenomenon. So, of course, I had a relationship with them. Then when I became chair and helped to write the criteria for the Ira and Aneva Riley Wisconsin Idea Endowment, which was a $20 million gift, a little more than that, but $20 million that went into this one big fund to use our students, staff, and faculty to transfer the knowledge and expertise of the university to the people of the state. And our strength is in our people versus facilities, is what the trust document said. And this was students, faculty, and staff. So we wrote criteria for a grant open to students, faculty, and staff to transfer our knowledge and expertise. Well, they came in with a proposal dealing with how language really is important to people. And it's like, if you have a proposal coming in that says, if we do step one, step two, step three, we'll create this curriculum thing, and then we can test it, and we can find out if our seventh graders know math better at the end of the year. You can sort of look at very easy, but if you have a project that talks about how people view language and how people view the acquisition of language and in immigrants and all this, it's much harder to sell. You know, what does that really mean to the people? But one of the things that, so they came in and one of the things they said in the pre-proposal, and this was when when immigration and the acquisition of language was getting all kinds of comments in the press. Oh, the new immigrants don't know our language. They're not learning our language. Well, what they were finding out is they were learning our language within one generation versus the Germans who settled in the state who took three generations. At German schools, German newspapers, even with the state law, you know, for 30 years taught in German. Well, given the fact that there was what I would consider a lot of misinformed anger in the public, we thought, wouldn't this be interesting to look at how people learn language, the importance of it, how immigrants learn language, and share that with the people of the state. So I helped them develop an argument for the committee. Now, as chair of the committee, I couldn't vote on anything, because I helped everyone who came to me in any way I possibly could. And after the first year, I realized it wasn't fair for me to cast a vote. As chair, I could often interject a point of knowledge I thought the committee might need understanding, or they would often ask me, look, you've worked in outreach for 30 years on campus. Are these people going to produce or not? So there's value. So they developed this project, and there were a couple of other professors involved in it beside the original founders of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. And they shared information, and they were just nice. And because I had my little grotto project on the side, Joe came to me and said, geez, we finished this book. What we'd like to do is couch it in why we were doing this. So I wrote the foreword that really looked at, you know, the fact that this project, believe it or not, was an outreach project. Language means a lot, and this is what we're trying to do, and this is what they're trying to do. So they just asked me to write the foreword to it. So again, Troy, I believe this is a case where, as with Sea Grant, when you have a center or a study, a group that works on something, they break down. It doesn't matter if you're faculty, if you're academic staff, if you're a student. When you're working on a problem and you can bring in expertise to that area, they were more than willing to accept that. You know, and that was what's, you know, and so the one part I didn't mention about academic staff when you talked about that is I thoroughly believe where you have teams of people working on problems or working on challenges or working on opportunities, where you have teams of people, even instructional academic staff and faculty, you'll have a lot more respect in some areas, you know, because they're used to working on that and it breaks down the barriers and there isn't that hierarchical structure. And I'll take one step back too and say in governance, the academic staff executive committee and the academic staff assembly, which I was asked to participate in, but when I worked in the provost office, that was not appropriate. I'm working for administration. I can't work for governance and administration. It wouldn't be fair to the committee or me or the provost. I couldn't be in a meeting where they're going, oh, this person is in a governance committee. I mean, you're supposed to be part of the team. But I don't believe the academic staff governance is very strong here. You know, really faculty and students hold a lot more power from my point of view. So, you know, I didn't, you know, participate in it that much, but... Well, that was an aside. I forgot something. So if I was editing it, I'd move that to the other part of the tape. But so the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures is really, again, illustrative of how this place works from an entrepreneurial point of view when you have groups of people looking at each other's talents and moving forward. And I'll say that with the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery, I was in a group that proposed one of the finalist proposals that didn't get accepted. And I was asked by a faculty committee to participate in that because of my science outreach expertise. And that group looked at me around the table as if I was just as valuable as anyone else bringing in a particular set of knowledge to build the proposal stronger. So, and again, you can see why I say passion, because when you have people that work hard, that you like, that are doing things that go beyond what they're supposed to be doing, that want to take it to people, that want to push what they're doing. Well, that's cool, you know, that's to me, so.
Thank you. So two more things to give you space from what you talked about last time. And I think both in the first and the second session you talked about tying campus resources to K through 12 education. I think once it was in regards to science, and the other time was in regards to librarians.
Or humanities libraries. And things, yes. Yeah. So, I have been involved in outreach on campus my entire career. Even in Bascom, when John Wiley brought me up to the provost's office, then the vice chancellor's office, it was to work on outreach, continuing education, the extension function. Some of it's straight up administrative, dealing with budget issues and reporting to system about what our continuing education programs do, how much money they make, how many FTEs we have, are we in budget, here's the authority, blah, blah, blah. But there are other things. My first job on campus was science outreach. And in the Earthwatch radio program that I helped start, established back in 1972, we hired a lot of undergraduates and graduate students that went on to work in science outreach on campus, and one of my students became the science reporter for campus, Terry Davitt, the top science person at the Office of University News and University Communications now. And so that was always an interest of mine. During the Baldwin proposal, the first 4 or 5 years, we were getting huge numbers of proposals to deal with science and K through 12. And most of them were, I got a great idea, I'm going to work with these two science teachers, hey, one in Stevens Point, one in Milwaukee, or one in Madison, or one here, and we're going to change the world, change curriculum. We got a graduate student that's going to go do this. So every one of them is sort of like, how do you make a connection with schools? Well, it's a partnership kind of thing. But we didn't have an organized way to constantly dealing with schools. You have curriculum issues, you have teachers who'll do anything. But you also have a huge set of these teachers need to do these curriculums for this. We need to prepare our materials directly for the curriculum. When they develop standards, we need to tie those curriculum to standards if you really want to get them addressed. Teachers are not lazy people. They work real hard. And, you know, to incorporate a new thing takes some extra energy. Well, I looked at all these proposals and I made it, are they connected with any school? Are they connected with any other people on campus? And I made a case to Pat Farrell at the time, the provost, that we need an Office of Science K through 12 education in order to help all the other people doing outreach have a place where you go and say, boy, they've already got partnerships with schools. They know how to do this. Let's try to really work together to coordinate our things. Pat Farrell was moving very strong forward in that we had some allocations, some resources set aside, and we were moving forward as part of the new campus strategic plan. But when Biddy Martin came in, there was new directions, and then Pat got, he left. That dropped down. But we did set up that, and I was able to help establish that there was an office there in the Center for Biology Education. Tom Zinnen and Kevin Nemi. Tom Zinnen in biotech. Tom took a trip out in Washington, D.C. to do a couple of years stint at the federal government. So we put some small resources into the Center for Biology Education to try to coordinate our science outreach activities to help the people translate their knowledge, but to also shortcut the amount of energy they have to do in terms of developing partnerships with schools or school systems or knowing how curricular things are. So we have this huge science outreach activity on campus, huge, but a lot of it could, I thought, be better served by having a, not a central place where you have to go through, but a resource center that really attracts people because it develops something better. And I actually thought a center for outreach would be good. Now I'll take one step back, and you said something about in another area. It was in the humanities. We looked at, and this was another area I was looking at, K through 12 and community partnerships between our humanities. And I proposed a project to the Division of Continuing Studies, to the business school that had a master's in arts administration, and to the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters. Because I did things with the Academy, with outreach. We partnered with them with many statewide programs where it was a good parallel partnership. And we did a study of what's the humanities outreach in the area, arts and humanities, and how are we working with community organizations or other organizations or anything. So I also looked at how we were also dealing with external audiences. And a lot of times it was, Troy, you decided to do something, you got the grant to do it. I decided to do something, I got the grant to do it. Or a center has as part of their mission doing that. But again, it was very decentralized. Now, I always looked at this campus and said, at times we're too decentralized. And that creates a lot of people working, not necessarily always aligned in the same direction, doing really neat things. And then when money got tight, it was real hard to get things done. So there's been this constant give and take at our institution between when I got big grants, I could start something, and when they shrunk, they disappeared. So where's that happy medium between having a central service and a decentralized? And I was hoping that, like some of the big medical school grants that dealt with the translational research into medicine, where they actually had, if you will, groups of people that were helping to facilitate change and no knowledge, that you could develop a community in the K-12 science outreach area that would move everyone forward with less energy because we would have experts in the area that you could go talk to. And that's what I served as the Baldwin Grant Chair. And when I worked in outreach in general, people came to me and asked me how to do things. Well, I like telling them what I thought they might be able to do, but that also helped me find partners and do new things, and it helped me put people together. And I barely went out. When people come in and ask you to help, they usually want your help, so these were willing people to move forward. And I guess I'd say the other reason why K through 12 science outreach as a focus, because I've developed on campus for no better reason, just my own energy, is a rule of thirds. A third of the people are willing to move forward and try new things. A third of the people are going to wait to see if it's working or not, and they're doing good, competent work. And a third of the people may just be resistant, or it may convince them a long time to change. So I would always go with the innovators. Why, we don't write ourselves into action, we act ourselves into action. So I didn't need to change a lot of minds. We go with some innovators, and the innovators, we'd use language that was important in their fields. So the School of Education, it's important to have curriculum that's real. In the science area, when you want to convince your federal grantors, that you are doing something right, if you said that you've got some schools nailed and it's a great experimental place to roll that out, to learn new biotechnology applications or whatever, biochemistry, whatever, your chances are that you may have a one-up on your competitor. Well, I always grew up in the grant world initially and in the program revenue, so I always thought like that. I hope that makes some sense.
No, that's great. So the last thing before we get to our final two questions is, right at the end, you talked a little bit about the Cluster Hire program, particularly that you did some evaluating of it, and I wanted to make sure we had space for you to talk about your involvement in the Cluster Hire.
Well, the Cluster Hire program was started before I was, here. It started in the sesquicentennial, so yes, I was involved in seeing Chancellor David Ward's initial move forward in the government. I wasn't involved in the behind the scenes that helped David Ward move that, but definitely was cognizant of his conversations with Governor Tommy Thompson and how we're moving forward, and how initially we got 12 biological science faculty members and then turned that into the Sesqui Hire and then the Cluster Hire. But it wasn't really my idea. But when I worked in the provost office then, I became a supportive person to the vice provost. So Linda Green was a vice chancellor for academic affairs, associate vice chancellor, and the associate provost, the same things again. But she did the first evaluation, and I came in where there were a number of committees that had already did it, and I wrote the report for her, drafted it. And then we did a second report under Lori Beth Clark, who was another vice provost who moved in. And those vice provost positions are almost like a resume builders for the people who come in. They come in, they do something for 3 to 5 years, they leave. The next person may come in and do something different. So it was very frustrating. You ramp something up and go down. Mm-hmm. So I ended up also providing the administrative support behind the scenes. And this is a program that had its goal to hire 150 faculty members to reverse the trend of declining faculty members that we saw in the 80s. And they were in interdisciplinary areas. They were supposed to break down the boundaries between departments and look at new innovative research and educational areas that would keep us at the forefront of interdisciplinary innovation and that kind of activity. Well, there were three different sources of funds. It was a one-third state money, one-third University of Wisconsin foundation money, and one-third Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation money. Now, these are three separate institutions. The money flows into the state, so we're all dealing with state monies. But there are different formulas as to whether or not the fringe benefits come with it or they don't come with it. So each salary item, and we don't have one spreadsheet, we don't have budget accounting that says we're dealing with all these three groups. So I basically had to help develop a budget tracking mechanism with the graduate school that really did that, and Jim Knickmeyer. God bless his soul. He passed away a couple years ago, but he was one of the best colleagues you could ever have. Tim Norris on campus, a budget person, was one of the best colleagues you could ever possibly have. But, the state gives us money when we spend it. The foundation, University of Wisconsin Foundation, we built at the end of the, build at the end of the year. Wharf would give us the money at the beginning of the year. Well, can you imagine a lot of people who don't know budgets, and you're dealing with three different things, and you're dealing with more than one fiscal year, and what's in the bank you may have encumbered, but it doesn't show up as encumbered because there are three different things. Well, I also developed the support behind that to help, again, with the other people. So I was very invested in that. Lori Beth, first Linda Green, that's when I started. Most of the meetings had already happened. I took the notes and attended the second half of the meetings, wrote it. By all measures that we could come up with, it was succeeding for the most part. The second evaluation we did, things were moving forward, and Lori Beth Clark, who was vice provost at the time and faculty member in arts and former assistant dean in the School of Education, that was a revolving position too. She spent most of her tenure doing an annual interdisciplinary conference, and we were involved in interdisciplinary discussions all over the place. She met with the divisional committees to talk about how do you grant tenure in these areas when someone has to have expert competence in more than one field. And she really delved into what is interdisciplinary work. You know, it can be from I just know your stuff, though I'm an expert in your area. I mean, there are different levels. I wasn't involved in that as much as just helping the groups that were moving forward foster themselves better. The ones that were more successful overall were housed in places like the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures, or places that also had another core there. If you had four faculties that were going to do this, but there was no supportive mechanism, it was harder for those faculty necessarily to have a place to gel around or a place to sort of hang your hats on outside of their departments. You're working for two. I had two bosses almost half of my career, so I know how that is dealing with two masters, so I like that. But mostly I did support on that. I was frustrated that some of the faculty still didn't understand the budget differences. I mean, certainly the campus did. And then Steve Stern, the last rendition of it, he took over, and at that point I sort of backed off because I was leaving. I actually said, I'll help you move it to the future if you will allow me to be part of the process rather than just a bump on the log or a bump on a pickle, I said. Take notes and follow up what you're doing. He had his own idea what to do, so that was fine with me. Mm-hmm. So I actually was greatly involved in the cluster program till sort of the end. And it was a shame in a way because it was coming to the point where we didn't have enough money for the initial $15 million to fill the faculty positions. But the committee was sort of saying, shrink it. And I was not necessarily involved in shrinking. I wrote it. The first evaluation had the history of what the agreement was. And so I reviewed that with the UW Foundation, with the campus, and with the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. Well, money problems happened after that. We had a great big crash, if you remember, somewhere around 2001 or something like that. And the money from the foundations and from the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundations, you know, they're sort of looking at, oh, well, we don't have the resources we had during the growth of the 90s. So they're sort of holding up, and it was very interesting as how a new faculty member would talk to some of those people and rewrite the history of what it was when you look back and said, well, here's the agreements by all the parties, and now one of the parties is saying something different. Mm-hmm. You know, so I thought it would be best for me. It's really a faculty program, and it wasn't my expertise, but I did have fun. I presented at an interdisciplinary conference with 10 universities around the country on the future of interdisciplinary activities. So at the time, you know, there was a lot of it, and it was fun. And again, the program I worked in the beginning was interdisciplinary. You know, it was applied. It dealt with outreach. Well, a lot of the clusters, all of them were interdisciplinary. Most of them were applied. If they weren't applied to external, they were applied to revamping curriculum and providing new educational opportunities. Mm-hmm. And they all involved a bunch of different people mixing things up, which I dealt with in my different careers, because they were definitely places, none of which was in one department. They were all cross-institution every place I worked. So it was sort of fun mixing it up. Mm-hmm. But I actually, on the second evaluation report, didn't put my name on it. I told the faculty member I wouldn't put my name on it because I just didn't agree with what was going on. And I had a senior enough position that I could say, I'll do it for you. I'm not going to, I'll write your recommendations. I don't disagree with your recommendations. I just don't see this as something. It's a great program, though. You know, as all programs, some of it should be shrunk. and combine. You know, you shouldn't let everything go forever. And having justifications for replacing the faculty members and why it's valuable, we developed criteria for that. It was just getting to the point where it was so mature that you could do that. Something that starts 3 years, you can't necessarily penalize someone if they're moving in the right direction and someone left. Mm-hmm. You could see, boy, this is just a dead in the water to begin with, which is not really all that many, because we had people who were doing some good work. But so we looked at all these different clusters, and it was really neat to see what they were doing, how they were doing it, you know, what the issues were. As a result of that, I was able to look at other studies that were done on interdisciplinary activities across campus. I looked at faculty committee reports on should you have separate tenure policies for clinical faculty in the School of Medicine or not. So I was really able to go back and look at the culture of faculty and why they do what they do and all that. And I was pretty good at understanding that and writing those reports. So, but that was it.
Okay. All right, so we have two more things. The first is, and you've alluded to this a little bit, but after you retired, you were asked to come back on a couple of projects. I wonder if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about what those projects were or are.
Well, the real simple one was when I left, they didn't hire someone to continue the pre-proposal and full proposal process for the IRA and Eneva Riley Baldwin, Wisconsin ID Endowment. So you get about 150 pre-proposals. You have a committee that reviews them. You have to look at continuing reports for year two and year three progress to see are you going to give them money year two and three, because we only gave out money for each year to make sure that they were moving forward. If they're not moving forward, we could pull some of that back and give it to other people. Mm-hmm. And in managing, you know, the books on that grant program, how much money did we make during the investments because it came from the UW Foundation. They allocate resources to campus. We allocated money in the future, but we held back in the foundation because we did not want to have more money allocated than we had in the bank. So it looks like maybe we have $500,000 in there for 2 years, but it's really allocated because we'd give out $700,000 to $1 million a year, depending upon the return. A couple of years, $1.2 million. And I was working on a very large educational project to help foster the science outreach activities that the committee allocated a certain amount to help do that with, you know, so there were those. So the first year they didn't hire anyone, they asked me to come back. And so for a half time for 5 months or so, I managed that project. I did some other things as well, little pickups, you know, that the office asked me. Then the second year I said, we're done, you know, but they still didn't hire someone. So they called me back to do that a second year. And that's when I had someone in the provost office, Eden Inouye-Rani, sit on the committee, and she determined that she could do it from then on. Someone should be working on campus to run the process, to stay tuned with what's going on. I can't tell you how many times people came to me and said, we're thinking of this, and I could look at them and said, you better talk to these three different people. They're doing the same things. We're not going to fund that unless you're combining your activities with them. If it doesn't work, I'm sorry, but you know, the committee is going to look at that and say, what's up? You know, why do we have competing ideas in the same school and college, for goodness sakes? Or why can't these two schools and colleges work together? They have really good complementary teams. So they brought me in a second year to do that, and that was only on the agreement that we transition it. And I wasn't planning on doing that. And then I thought I'd be done. The administration changed up completely, but I was called and asked to write a 30-year history of the Chancellor's Scholarship Program, which is a program run out of the Chancellor's Provost's Office. I was a mentor for the program, somewhat familiar with it. I was looked at as someone who could write something because I wrote the cluster higher evaluation reports. A lot of people are afraid of writing. So if you write something, they think you're better than you really are, and they're impressed. And if you want to control, not an agenda, but if you want to move things forward, it's always, you know, okay to volunteer to, you know, put something on paper. It helps moves things forward. But again, I always did it with, this is to get us to action, not to just write, to try to get us to action. So, okay. Well, that's that.
So the last question is the legacy question. So what would you like to be remembered for your time on campus? It doesn't have to be just one thing.
Wow.
I like to end with a big, huge, open-ended question. So yeah. That's the
I don't expect to have a legacy on campus. There's 5,000 academic staff. I was not a, you know, managing or running a great big operation where someone's going to look and say, oh, this person changed financial aid or this or that. When I ran the sesquicentennial, the first meeting we had where the chancellor came in and we pulled people in alumni relations and constituent relations and communications across campus, John Wiley came late. The meeting ran late. And so someone in the audience jokingly said, well, we'll take these few minutes and we'll talk about how Peyton's influenced my life. And I was really surprised how many people that viewed me as a help to them at one point or another when they came and asked for advice, or who had worked with me or for me at Earthwatch or, you know, on a project. And a lot of them were getting communications or outreach, you know, definitely. But I guess I really don't think, I think when all said and done, you know, someone like me, who's a sort of a behind-the-scenes support player, it is not always the number, you know, not, I didn't try to get all these awards or do any, I never applied for any awards. I applied for grants. I'd rather get an extra $5,000 to $50,000 to $100,000 to do something than to get some award on campus, to tell you the truth. So I never applied for any of those. But I guess, if anything, I would hope that I helped advance one of the three core values that I've mentioned before of this institution, and that would be the Wisconsin idea, where the resources, the knowledge, and the expertise of the university should be transferred to people of the state. So I would help that with my effort of helping people all across campus do that, and with my helping to initially write the criteria for the Baldwin Endowment and share that and set a precedent of how that worked, which I thought was cross-campus, which I thought was really looking at the strength of the activities, which was not, you know, going to support my friends or this or that, but support the best ideas. So, you know, I guess my legacy, if there was one, would be that some of those programs are strong enough that they continue, and that this institution maintains its commitment beyond the walls of the camp or beyond the borders of the campus. But I really don't, you know, it's not like I'm a scientist who wrote groundbreaking papers that resulted in these new advances or anything. I was just sort of a yeoman in many cases, moving things forward, having a wonderful time, because people allowed you to work here for the most part.
Peyton, I want to thank you very much for your time. So this concludes the third and final interview with Peyton Smith.